any of your questions. Yes.
I just want to say thank you. That's a really, really interesting talk for me. Well done. But I wanted to ask, it may be a different talk, but on the influence of creativity within Buddhism, because you said about that. Is that just a completely different talk, or did he, in some way, was he creative in his life as well? Or how did, how was creativity? Because I've just heard bits and pieces about... How it's a really important part of it is to everyone to be creative. And to
absolutely, yeah. Well, I hope we will have a talk on creative and the reactive mind, looking at that. And I hope that will bring in also the sense of creativity in the arts. And my, you know, my area is more in science. And creativity is just so important. And I think that, you know, he would say and I would say that really to be a fully rounded human being, you need some kind of a, is outlet the right word, or some kind of a way of finding expression for yourself in a way that you don't, isn't just imitating other people. And that can happen in the movement as a whole. You know, so I think that Tri Ratna needs to be a creative movement. I think he was very creative in how he set it up, and I think we need to be creative. We don't want to be constrained by saying, no, that's not, you're not supposed to do it that way, this is the way you're supposed to do it. Novelty needs to emerge and come into it. But without it, also, how do you keep unity if you do that? Is everybody doing it in their own way? Do we all have our own special chants and pujas and meditations? Or do we have some things that we can do together? So a very interesting balance there, isn't there, between keeping unity and being able to do things together, but yet really encouraging creativity. And one obvious area there is the arts. And his preferred art, from his own point of view, is poetry. And some of his poetry is pretty bad, in my opinion. But it's worth reading his poetry. It really gives you a different slant on him, actually, if you read his poetry. I mean, when I say bad, maybe it's a bit wrong, but it's derivative. Some of his poetry is derivative. It's
some
been too
really good.
Some yes, very good poems, very, very moving poems. That's where you really see where his heart is. But sometimes I think he was a little bit too influenced by the genres that he was looking at. You know, he started off as a bit of a Victorian poet, and then he became a bit of a beat poet and was influenced by the Liverpool poets. And anyway,
why do you think creativity is important within Buddhism?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think we will come back to it, but so I'll try and do it very, very briefly. But it seems to me that the whole Buddhist life is creating yourself. That's what you're actually doing, isn't it? You can't just go round in circles. You have to actually rise into the unknown. So how do you get into the unknown? In a way, you're making something new by going into the unknown. And so you are your greatest work of art, really. But that work of art, writing a poem or making a picture or, you know, understanding nature deeply, all those sort of things, can be a small creativity that leads to the great creativity of making yourself. You know, a Buddha is somebody who's created themselves in a way as fully as they possibly can. And it's interesting that Buddhism doesn't believe in a creator god. In a way, the creator is the individual in Buddhism, not an external force. You don't rely on that, you know. But thanks for the question. It's a good one. Yeah. Yes, Tim.
There's a question about the name, because when originally it was set up, it was Friends of the Western Buddhist Order.
That's correct, yes.
And I always thought that was slightly curious. It sounds a bit like sort of Friends of the Victorian Albert Museum.
Yes.
It's kind of slightly distant from the actual subject. Why was, or do you know why that was originally the idea?
Yes, I think I do.
Then later on there was obviously this change of name to Tri Ratna.
Tri Ratna, yes.
And why did it change?
Well, in brief, Sangha actually decided to set up an order, not a society. So it was a Buddhist order. So in English, he definitely wanted to call it the something Buddhist order. Yeah. Now, he felt he was actually breaking out something new. He wanted it not to be an Eastern form of Buddhism. So he decided to call it, to make that clear, by calling it the Western Buddhist Order. And so the order I was ordained into was, at that time, was actually known as the Western Buddhist Order. And in a way, that was very self-explanatory. Now, a year before the order started, he wanted to start up an organisation that would support, a charitable organisation that would support the Western Buddhist Order. And so he called that the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And so this would be people who were not necessarily ordained and weren't even wanting to be ordained necessarily, but they wanted to support the work of the Order. So that's why he called that charitable organisation the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And he set it up in such a way in the end that it became many, many independent charities. So this was known as FWBO West London. And it was an independent charity, but it was a that was supporting the work of the order in this particular area. Now, I didn't talk much about his work in India amongst the ex-untouchables. I didn't really say anything about it. But here's Dr. Ambedkar, who we had some celebration of earlier, one of the great Buddhists of the 20th century. Sangharakshita knew him and very much supported his work in emancipating the ex-untouchables by helping them to convert away from Hinduism into Buddhism. And of course, that work meant that Sangharakshita had loads of contacts there. And so after, you know, probably the biggest number of order members is in Europe, but the second biggest number is in India. And over the years, the Indians, more and more of them were really puzzled. Why am I joining a Western Buddhist order? It's ridiculous. I'm not Western. And so it actually had a different name in India, and people would get really confused about it, you know. And they were sort of pushing this. And in fact, there's a lot of debate in the order. The order, to some extent, is anarchistic and run by sort of a consensus process. So at first, there are loads of suggestions for how could we give it a different name that was that really represented the, you know, maybe we call it the World Buddhist Order or something like that, you know. And in the end, this name came up, Triratna, the Three Jewels Buddhist Order. So that's why it was changed to that. And rather than calling it, you could have said that the whole movement would be the friend of the Triratna Buddhist Order, but actually they decided to say we'll have the Triratna Buddhist Community for the charitable organisations that help the order, and the Triratna Buddhist Order as the order. Does that make some sort of sense?
Yeah, just to add one thing, the problem, because Triratna also makes sense because of the centrality of going for refuge, to go back to that. But that was so central.
Yes.
And the Three Jewels is what you go to for refuge to, and it's what's on the queso.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it goes right back to the founding principle. At one point, I think Sangharakshita said you can change anything about how we do things in the order except the centrality of going for refuge.
Yeah, which is an interesting one, isn't it? You know, it's, he's flexible. He's flexible, and things have changed quite a lot. Any other? Oh, did you have something?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask. I know maybe it's not that important, but did Sangharakshita actually get to meet Dalai Lama, and was he actually influenced by him in any way?
Yeah, he did. He did. He knew the Dalai Lama quite well, and had a number of meetings with him. But the Dalai Lama was in. Dharamsala. So the Dalai Lama was in Dharamsala, and Sangharakshita was over in Kalimpong. And so his, and in fact, interestingly enough, this is getting a little bit technical, but the majority of his Tibetan teachers were from the Nyingma school. The Dalai Lama, as you probably know, is from the Gelug school. So he, if his Tibetan sort of affiliations were mainly with the Nyingma school, where interestingly enough, the Gelug school is a more monastic school. So the Dalai Lama is a monk, he's a celibate monk, but most of his teachers were married lamas, not all of them, but they were married lamas because the Nyingma school tends to have married lamas in it. And that was what he mainly learnt about. So I think it's fair to say that he's been friendly with the Dalai Lama, you know, the contacts they have had.
I think the Dalai Lama came to visit him in Kalimpong one day.
Yes,
quite a lovely story about
that. Yeah, there's a photograph of them
Western,
together, isn't there?
Celebration.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
So he was not like directly influenced by him. Obviously, he wasn't his teacher.
Yeah, he wasn't one of his teachers. No, the particularly the three in the top row, who are three very, very important. The three most important Nyingma teachers of the 20th century, who were his teachers: Dzogchen Rinpoche, Jonrin Kense Rinpoche, and Dilma Kense Rinpoche. Any other thoughts?
What would you say? You may think you've answered this, but what was the most important thing or most helpful thing that you learned from Sangharakshita?
I think, you know, to give a really honest answer, I have to really think about that carefully because I've learned so much. I mean, I think you'd have to look in the different areas, and what I value most is the fact that I was able to live in the same community as him for 5 years. And to actually see somebody really practicing Buddhism and gradually get the sense of this is what it's like for somebody to be really practicing, really working on himself, watching him meditate, watching him be mindful, watching him respond to others with kindness, watching him deal with his own demons and his own problems, all that kind of thing, I found really helpful. Not that I was doing the same thing, but it's not that I wanted to follow his example in the sense of copying him, but I could see that is how you if you like, go for refuge, I suppose. So definitely that's one thing. But then the other thing that I got from him, which is more of an esoteric thing, is the ordination itself. And, you know, I was out on a three-month retreat in Tuscany, in a remote place, in this old crumbling monastery. And, you know, after I'd been there for about 2 months, you know, there it was, you know, and we were all meditating, doing metta bhavana together. And then I had to sort of leave and follow this little winding avenue of little tiny candles, go up the stairs, down the corridor, to a little room at the end, one of the old monk's cells. And then it was like a, you know, this magical experience, after which I suppose you could call initiation in a way. Not that anything really esoteric happened. I could be happy to describe exactly what happened, but it's as if what did happen is not really describable, I suppose. So there is a sense in which he introduced me to something in the ordination ceremony, I suppose. And when I performed an ordination, because I'm a preceptor just for one person, and when I performed an ordination, in a way, I wanted to do to carry on that sort of transmission, I suppose, as best I could, for the person I ordained. Yes.
You said he was no longer the head of the order. Is there a head of the order, or is it more?
No, there's a collective head. So I mentioned that he appointed people to confer ordinations. So now the preceptors, specifically what are known as the public preceptors, are the head of the order. That's right, isn't it? Mm. So it's a collective. It's a group. I don't know if that's sensible or not, because I know, funny enough, you know, he's slightly critical of the Buddha, because the Buddha refused to name a successor, and Sangharakshita felt that some of the problems in the beginnings of Buddhism, where it split up a lot, was possibly because the Buddha refused to name a successor and told everybody, look, the Dharma is your teacher, that's what you've got to follow. But having said that, maybe later he realised the Buddha was right, and he didn't name a successor. At least he's still alive, but you know, he hasn't named a successor. He's passed it on to a group of people rather than an individual person.
But also, yes, the interesting thing is they're kind of the head of the order in that they're conferring ordinations, but they're not sort of hierarchically the head of the order deciding everything, because every centre still operates in a self-organising way. So that's how.
So nobody tells us what to teach here or anything like that.
In a good way. Yeah.
Yes, interesting. Thank you. We've just got time maybe for one more, if someone's got a question. Or shall we leave it there?
I don't know if this is a useful question. I was just really surprised to hear you say you weren't religious, so...
Yes.
Yeah, you got that. So, how would you describe it?
Yeah, there was a time when I was the chair of the Cambridge Buddhist Centre, and somebody said, "Oh, yeah, you're just like a vicar, aren't you?" And I really hated that.
I don't want to be like a vicar.
It was the last thing. My mum used to send me to Sunday school every Sunday. No. So it's probably just my sort of prejudice that says that, you know.
Surprising he's not enlightened. I'm sorry, he's still maybe got a bit of time, or is he still out of a goal, or because he
referred
to the thought being unenlightened?
Well, that's another, and that's a whole other very interesting area in a way, isn't it? You know, how do you get enlightened? Is he still making spiritual progress? You know, it's a bit difficult. I'm really impressed by him as a spiritual being, you know. As I say, that consistent kindness I've never seen from anybody else, that degree of consistency, including other, you know, high up Buddhist teachers that I've met. So he's pretty impressive, but I'm, you know, he himself says that he still has faults and flaws and so on, and I'm sure that's true, you know. And you know, to some extent, it's going to be much more difficult. It's going to be easier to see what his blind spots and problems were after he's died. You have this sort of inhibition, in a way, almost at seeing it, while somebody you have a lot of respect for is still alive. But I think after he's died, probably we'll be able to see, well, very good in this respect, not so good in this respect, and all that kind of thing. Now, of course, he's very naughty. He ought to have gained enlightenment by now. I think he should send a letter of complaint. You know, there are you. You started at 16. More than 70, that should be enough time to gain enlightenment. That is absolutely disgraceful. Really, you know?
Not, as you say. I thought people didn't say.
No, they don't say that kind of thing. No, and in fact, you know, one person once asked him, and he said, "Well, if I said I was enlightened, would that be be helpful? You know, or would you believe me? You know, if I said I wasn't enlightened, would that help you? You know, what's the point of saying? So in a way, he has reached a stage where you refuse to say, I'm perfectly happy to say I'm not enlightened, because I'm quite sure I'm not. but he sort of deflects that kind of a question. But, you know, but I mean, yeah, who knows? Who knows? But I mean, I don't really know what enlightenment is. I know, you know, if the records we have of the Buddha and of some of those other great enlightened teachers are of people who are even more amazing than Sangharakshita. So there's a chance in his next life he's going to have to get even more amazing.
He thought one of his teachers was enlightened, didn't he? Dada Rinpoche. He was quite convinced of it.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, he's certainly met people who he's been absolutely blown away by. Okay, so we're going to leave it there. Next week, Akasha Devi will look at going for refuge, which I hope you will find interesting.